to be complications because you're in a rush. You want to cover, and especially the way we were trained, we want to cover ground. So the thing is, it's going to start being complications. Once you have complications, then you build complications upon complications, and it becomes work. But if your motive is only to see the truth, and you know that's the only thing that benefits you is the truth itself, so then you will not go further until you will not go to another level until you actually have total control over the level that you're at. Like, for instance, sometimes in yeshiva, some guys want to go up to the Rosh Yeshiva Shir, to the highest class. It's an ego thing. That is not a way of making decisions. You should stay in a class where you're the best, and to make sure you learn everything that there is to learn on your level. Then once you learn it on your level, then move on to the next level. But it should be 100% clear, because when you go to the next level, then if you don't have everything clear, that's when you start running into trouble, and you're going to have to start skipping steps to fool yourself into grasping, even though you don't have all the steps. Okay? So therefore, the complications, it's true when you first start learning, it has to be complications. But if you stick at your level, the complications can be easily removed, and you have the ability to remove it. But the problem occurs when you go beyond your ability and you start harming yourself, like you see by Moses, when God spoke to Moses by the burning bush, so he covered his face. So sages say that was because he felt he wasn't ready for the prophecy that he was going to get. He felt he wasn't ready for the prophecy, and he didn't want to accept the prophecy because he wasn't ready for it. So sages say that's why later on God gave him a lot of knowledge about God, because he did not go, in other words, beyond his ability, and he knew to stop at that point and not to accept the prophecy, and he was rewarded for that. So therefore, we certainly, you know, when we're learning by a teacher, we should make sure we stick with the teacher until we get everything that we can out of him, and then move up to the next level when we're in total control with the ideas on the first level. Then there will not be complications. Okay, the question is, am I connecting laziness and impatience? Because first we were talking about laziness, now we're talking about impatience to get ahead. The answer is no. What I am connecting is showing how the sense of reality, when you're extending it, how to operate, the best way to study, the best way to acquire that sense of reality to the world of ideas, to extend it over to the world of ideas. I'm only trying to show you examples and different aspects, different ways, and the best ways that you could acquire that sense of reality. That attaches, you can't acquire a sense of reality, but you acquire a sense of reality to attach to the world of ideas. The Rabbeinu Yonah on Mishle mentions that that the simplest of all, the least abstract of all the studies that are in Torah is the study of Musa. Okay? Now let's say a person, the Rabbeinu Yonah says, let's say a person only has the ability, his mind is only, that he has the ability only to study Musa, to become a thinker in Musa, but he doesn't have the mental capacity to understand and grasp, let's say, ideas in Talmud, abstract ideas in Talmud and in philosophy of Torah. He doesn't have that ability. So Rabbeinu Yonah says he is accepted in the club of Chachamim, of wise people. Okay, which means that insofar as Moshe Rabbeinu is a Chacham, right, insofar as Moses, our teacher, is wise, so he would accept this person into the club called wise people. Okay? So, therefore, I want to explain that a person should only go at his level, and if he does that, that in itself is a wise person. That is a chacham already. and you'll be in the club. But if you have that other, if you're driven just to cover pages or to finish or to be known as a chacham and to show how much, and you do not work on each and every step and to train yourself in this area, then you'll be no more than a donkey carrying books, and you will not be wise, and you will be not in the club of the wise people. In other words, therefore, the reason why I brought this in is that you see a person, there's no rush. You must just get what you can. That is the real chacham. The chacham knows where he's at the time. Moshe Rabbeinu, when God wanted to give him prophecy, knew where he was. And he felt that he wasn't there, and he was rewarded for that. If you go at your pace, you'll be successful. If you rush, then you will fail. You might get there faster to begin with, but in the end, you have nothing. Okay? So therefore, you must go at your pace, whatever your pace is, whether slow or fast. The question is, how would I define Musser? I would say Musser, according to our conversation right now, Musser is the ability to make correct decisions based on ideas, where every step is there, even though my emotions are contrary to these ideas. That's what Musser tries to help you deal with. Question that I'd like to discuss today. One of the kids asked me in class, can you prove from the physical world that you would be obligated in justice without Torah? In other words, is it possible for other people to see the ideas that you need a system of justice? All right, so we wanted to say like this, that the... that if you look at the universe, and how we know that there is a God from the universe, is we see that there's order in every single area of the world, and so we see this order, we have a principle that if there is order, then there must be some motive and some rational being that has a motive for putting that order together. Okay? Now, if that is true, then it is impossible for God to leave a gap someplace that there is no water. In other words, in areas of building the world, you know what I mean? Like making farming utensils, cars, planes, all these things, there's one gap. In the emotions of the human, the conflict, you see that there's something missing there that's not in order. In society, the area of justice, you also see that there's no order. The question is, how come God created a whole system? Everything has a system in order that is perfect and could be defined, you know, according to science, you know, like the, how the system works. And yet, when it comes to human beings, everything seems to have gone wrong. How's that possible? 1 minute. In other words, if you look back on societies, you'll see very rarely was there a government run by justice. You understand? You have Moshe and Yehoshua, and you have David, and, you know, a few throughout the civilization that you had a few honest and just leaders that ran the government in a just way. Otherwise, basically, you see, it's all run by evil. Okay. The question is, can there be more than one system for justice? The answer is that if you know what justice is, so there can be different systems that are both just. Okay? I'll give you an example. Let's say, for instance, in every system of justice, you can't murder, okay, and you can't rob, okay, but to have that, you must have a definition of life, and you must have a definition of ownership. There is no scientific proof what is life and what is ownership. So therefore, one government will have a system where they define life differently than the other government, or they might define ownership differently than the other government. But as long as they're both just systems, so you could have two different countries, but you can't have two systems in the same society, because then there'd be total confusion. But you could have one system in one society and another system in another society, and both could be just. Okay, the question is, let's say Saddam had a system, what they call justice. The mafia has a system called justice, right? So the question is, which ones are right, right? The answer is that I'm not going, today anyway, I'm not going into systems of justice. How to define what makes it right, what makes it wrong, okay? But definitely those were systems that were unjust. But they called it justice. In other words, they called, this is our justice. Every society says, we have the just system. But I mean, there must be certain, that's why I said at the beginning, there must be certain rules and principles that you must have to define what is justice, and so that you could have a just system. But they don't always have to be the same. But there are other societies that they call it justice, and really it's unjust. Okay? In other words, I'm saying there are two societies, both could be just, but they can be different because there is no scientific proof of what is life and what is ownership. So therefore, it depends how you define it. There could be different definitions that would fit under a just system. They'll both be called justice. Okay. So what we're saying, insofar as our subject is concerned, the main thing that we want to say what justice is a certain system, that there has to be a certain system, and so that it works. In other words, God left a gap, but it is a gap that the human being could fill, so God gave over the human being to set up a system of justice. Okay? They left it to the human being, so that's where free will comes in, and that is our system, and that's how we get justice. So, in other words, that's the proof of justice. Since we see that God wants systems, and that he left the gap, sounds strange, so therefore we must say that God left the system of justice should be made by the human being, that they should have some system. Okay, that they should have some system. That's what we call justice. The first question, the question that we asked originally was, can we prove from the physical world without Torah that you must have a system of justice? And that's what we just did, based on our proof of God that there are systems in the universe. So we see that, and God, it's impossible to say that God left the gap. In other words, so the question is, why did God leave the gap? The answer is that he wants the human being to take responsibility for making a system of justice. Just let me clarify. Since we see there are systems in the world, the whole world, like astronomy, chemistry, the human being, everything, psychology, everything is all systems throughout the world. The ecological system, the food chain, everything is a system where you see that the system works perfectly except in one place, when it comes to the human. Now the question is, why should a God create a universe based on order and leave one place open? That was the original, that is how we proved it. Okay? In other words, how is that possible that he should leave one gap? The answer is, it must be that he left it to the human to create systems. In other words, the animal kingdom does not need a system of justice. The animal kingdom was created that they do everything perfectly. In fact, the planet Earth would be a perfect world without the human being. If God did not want a species to have free will and to take on responsibility for themselves, we would have a perfect system, be a perfect planet. But however, because God wanted free will, so therefore, because of that, so and free will necessitates responsibility, that responsibility, one of the responsibilities is justice. Okay? So therefore, I must take upon myself the idea of justice. But however, we're not doing too good a job. So it looks like there is a gap that God left out. It's not a gap. God left it out. He specifically left it out to give the human being that responsibility. All right. What about if a person does not accept God? Okay. Would there be any obligation to keep a legal system? So the thing is we're saying that if there is no God, then there is, in other words, there is no purpose to my life. In other words, I'm here and then I'm not here. So therefore, it doesn't make a difference. It would depend on my personality. If I'm a certain type of person, so I look for peace. If I'm a warrior kind, so I look for war. So the thing is, whatever my personality is, that's what I should do. But there is no compelling force to make me keep justice. So, but Doug says that you need a society, you need some system of justice because of practicality, okay? Because practically, if you don't have a system of justice, each person, we'd have to move back to the caves, and each person would have to defend his own cave. And also in a society, you wouldn't have the development, like working together, building a society. You have certain benefits from building a society. So the system of justice would be a practical system. So the question is there any difference between the system of justice if you have a proof based on God, or if you have a, or if you accept justice based on, even if there's no God, of practicality, is there any difference between the two systems?
No.
The question is that we have two ways of finding justice. One is either we go through the universe and we prove that there is a God from the systems. And once we see that God wants systems, so we see there's a gap, and we must fill that gap. That's one way of seeing justice. Or we could see justice because of a practical thing, because if there is no God, you still must accept justice for a practical reason, and that is because the society, there's great benefits in working together. If we don't work together, then we can't have buildings, we can't have factories. I mean, we have to have some system of justice to work together to produce things as a society. You have a better life of working together. So therefore, it is a better... So practically, you should have a system of justice. The question is there any difference between... Is there any practical difference between these two types of justice? In other words... All we're interested in is not the definition of justice, okay? That we're not working on. But however, if there are two causes, two different causes for justice, one is because God obligates me, and the other cause is practicality, because I'll see that the society will be destroyed, and plus they won't get the benefits of a society if they are not just. So therefore, we do it for practicality. I'm saying, is there a difference between the two types of justice if you accept justice because of God, or if you accept justice because of practicality? I'm not dealing with what is justice, okay? In other words, I'm not talking about the causes. I'm not talking about what is justice. I'm talking about the causes of justice. In other words, whether human sacrifices, if everybody agrees to a particular system of human sacrifices, I would say, whether it's just or unjust, I would assume it's unjust under any definition. But that has nothing to do with my subject. That has to do with the particular of what is a correct system of justice. What I am talking about is the causes of justice. What causes you to have a just system? In other words, is it God or is it practicality?
Yes.
All right. What we want to say is that there are two views, okay? If there is no God, then justice is subsumed under practicality. If there is a God, then practicality is subsumed under justice. An example, when Haman commanded everybody to bow down to him, now the question is Mordecai has to make a decision. Practically, he should bow down to Haman, because practically that's his life. I mean, his life is on the line. Justice demands that he does not bow down and give up his life. Okay? So the thing is that that would be one of the differences. In other words, if justice is subsumed under practicality, I'm not obligated to give up my life for justice. That's not practical. That'd be stupid. If it's only practical, I would keep justice because it's a benefit to me. But once it's not a benefit to me, then why should I keep it? But however, if it's objectively justice, that it comes from God, that I must keep it, then I must keep justice no matter what. I have to give up my life for it. One other example. Let's say I'm on a desert island. Now, if justice is subsumed under God, then there would be an obligation for me to study God's ideas of justice, of studying God's systems. This is part of God's systems, and that very knowledge would help perfect my soul and put me in line with God, because getting in line with God is studying systems. Justice is the system I must also study. But if it's practicality, if I'm on a desert island, it'd be absolutely worthless to study any type of justice. In other words, the thing is, what I'm trying to say is there is a difference. If you accept God because of the truth that you know God, you're going to relate to justice very differently than if you don't accept God. Okay? Now I want to say one more thing. That the truth is that emotionally, we really take justice as practicality. Emotionally, that's the way we look at it. We really don't look at justice objectively. Okay? And therefore, I think that there has to be to reach that level where justice is so important to your life that it's bound up with your relationship to God. It must be where the proof of God that comes from the systems, that comes through the study of different systems, that, in other words, you see God via the study of systems. And when you study the systems and you see God via the system, then you will truly see that you must live the life of justice, because then you really see that it's your responsibility via God. And once you see that, that will change your total relationship to the idea of justice. In other words, I don't think that just the idea a person is going to walk out and say, oh, okay, now I'm going to live justice very differently, and justice is central to my life. It doesn't happen that way. It must come about through the study either of systems of justice, like certain people, I think, could get this by studying halacha, you know, being involved in the study of halacha, or study of different systems where you really see that there has to be a God based on your studies. Not that I just know that there is a God somehow from the systems. But I see the systems. I study different systems. Halacha is one system. Astronomy is another. Physics is another. I mean, the different systems. And when I see these systems and I truly see God via the systems, and then I see that it's God's will to have justice, and that I can know from Torah or from the physical world. But when I see that, then justice becomes a different concept in my mind. It is not just a practical thing. It's not subsumed under being a nice person. It's not subsumed under practicality, but it is my religious conviction, and it's totally subsumed under my relationship to God, and it's part and parcel of my relationship to God. That is the only way that you could reach that level to relate to justice in that way, through really seeing that God wants systems, and that God wants that the human being should fill the gap of the system of human relationships. In other words, what I'm trying to bring out is not what justice is, but whatever justice is, there's a certain relationship to justice. Most people keep justice because they were raised that way, they're nice people, they're emotionally comfortable with justice, whatever these things are, that's how most people keep justice. Or for practicality, they keep justice that way. I'm saying that the motive that has to be to justice must be like Mordechai, that it's part and parcel of his relationship to God, and even if his life is dependent on it, he will still keep justice. Okay? Whatever justice demands, whatever system it is. Okay? Let me try to explain. In other words, like this. The Torah system of law, really, if you look at all laws, since we don't know the definition of life, nobody could prove that. Nobody could prove the definition of ownership, so therefore it's only practical, just so we should have a society, we have to have a system. Even if it comes about from God, the system must work out practically. Okay? However, the Torah system is in reality a system and not practicality. Why? Because since God told us the system, and since God is the source of all reality, so whatever God says is real. So since he gave me the Torah laws, so it's real by virtue that God gave it to me. But the other laws might fit under the category of practical, because God didn't give it to him, and nobody could prove one way or the other. So therefore, in other words, abortion. I mean, it depends how you define life. Since scientifically you can't define life, so there must be some way that you make a decision based on our system. Now, even if it's different from the Torah system, it's a practical system, but it's not unjust. You see, it's not unjust. So whether circumstantial evidence is just or unjust, I mean, that you first have to define justice, which we're not doing today. I'm just saying your relationship to justice. What I'm trying to clarify today is your relationship to justice, and how there's two ways of relating to justice, and how most people start, everybody starts out with their relationship to justice, either the way they were raised, I'm a nice person, or practically I have to have justice, or what will the neighbors think, whatever their motives are. I'm saying that you have to develop through the study to really see that God's will is that you should keep justice. Once you see that, then it's subsumed under your religious convictions, you see. Then there's a different, totally different motive for keeping justice. It's not the particular how you keep justice, but it's in your motivation and how important the life of justice is. Now, even if you're living on a desert island, to know God's will, you'd be obligated to study God's justice. But if it's practicality, I don't have to do it. But it's a difference in the way you relate to justice is what we're trying to bring out today. And a little clarification on the difference between. In other words, like this. If there is no God, then there's no purpose to life. It just happens. There's no purpose. It just happens. So therefore, the only thing is that while I'm here, to have a good life, and that's it. There's nothing else. There's no philosophy that it's all my philosophy must fit under practicality. But if there's a God, then all my practicality must fit into my relationship to God. It's a different philosophy of life. So therefore, if it's practical, so as long as the justice system is benefiting me, so of course I'm going to keep the system. But if it's a matter of life and death, then why should I keep the system? There's no practicality. Okay. Another way of viewing it is if there is no God, then justice is a means to an end. But if there is a God, then justice is inherent, an end in itself, in my relationship to God. Even the knowledge of justice becomes inherent in my relationship to God. The Chofetz Chaim brings a medrash, and the medrash says that God told Abraham that there will be destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And Avram asked God, what's the cause of the destruction? And he says, idolatry. And idolatry and happiness about the destruction of their enemies. When catastrophe happens to their enemies, so then they're happy. The Chavetz Chaim brings it down as from a medrash. He quotes a medrash. Okay? So the question is, I mean, it's two funny things. I mean, there could be so many other things. Why do they mention these two things, Avodah Zarah, idolatry, and they feel good and happy over the destruction of their enemy? I mean, what are these two things that cause the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? In other words, what do they have in common? What's the connection between the two? Does that matter if you destroy your enemy, or if you... If something happens to them and you're happy about their downfall, you don't have to cause their downfall, but you're happy about their downfall. Question is like this. What is the difference emotionally what's the emotional progression? Where are you going to reach if you live a life of Avodah Zarah or if you live the life of Torah? Wherein lies the difference in your emotions? In other words, if you live the life of Avodah Zarah, so then there are certain emotions that happen, okay, that are going to develop. You live the life of Torah, and certain other emotions are going to develop, okay? We'd like to know the difference in the development of the emotions in the two different types of, two different lifestyles. Since Avodah Zarah is created by you, it's created to satisfy your needs. So therefore it's egocentric. And therefore the more involved you are with religion, and especially your idea of religion that you're in the relationship with God, so you become more, the higher level of your ego, your ego will grow. Because of your greatness, you are better than anybody else because of your religion. Okay. However, when you're involved in the world of Torah, the highest level is what David HaMelech says in Tehillim. He says, "More enosh ki siskarena." What is man that he should be remembered or thought of by God? In other words, why should man create God? He doesn't even have an answer. In other words, he holds that he can't understand why God, the closer he gets to God, the closer he becomes smaller and recognizes that there's nothing much to the human. However, in idolatry, the more you get involved in idolatry, so then the greater you become and everybody becomes less. So therefore, because they are violated, and then there is no feeling for anybody else, because they are violating your religion, they're living differently than you, you cannot tolerate that they are different than you, so you're happy when they're destroyed. You're just happy when they're destroyed, because that is the highest level of idolatry. That's what you see by bin Laden. I mean, he was happy when people, he says... you know, he was laughing, he was enjoying it, that people were dying, and that people died, these were his enemies, you see? So the thing is that that's the result of idolatry, you see? That's the highest level of idolatry, you see? Because it goes in that direction, in the direction of I am everything, and anybody that disagrees with me is wrong, and they deserve to die. They deserve all types of punishments. But however, in Torah, the development goes to the opposite. It reaches a level of ma enosh ki siskarena. Who is man? You think, who is man that God should even think of him? Goes in the totally opposite direction of Avodah Zarah. Now that direction comes through the world of learning. In other words, it could be reached through the study of Musa, could be reached through the study of sciences. Scientists have come to it. It could be reached by an investigation into halacha, into the depths of halacha. It will bring about this quality. Any type of study where you see a system operating, then it will lead to this type of... in other words, systems in reality, then it leads to this type of emotion of humility, that you can't, you have the question of why should God even bother with us, and there is no answer for it when you see the greatness of God through his universe.
This,
in other words, avodah zarah and self-centeredness leads to my laughing at others and putting down others and happy when they fail. It will include lashon hara too. It will include lashon hara. But the thing is that self-centeredness, that is avodah zarah. And the proof that God is mine is where I see others fail. So that's a proof. It's also a proof that God is with me, in cahoots with me, and close to me, and not to anybody else. That is avodah zarah. But however, but we go in the opposite direction. Now the only thing is that when we're happy, when a success happens, like when the Egyptians died, we sang Shira, we sang Psalms. So the thing is, it's not because they died, but because we saw God's miracles. Because we relate to God, it's a relationship to God. And when we go out to harm somebody, it's only because we know it's God's will, but it's never personal. Personal, we don't take personal offense. You see? When we do it, it's because of halachic reasons that the halacha demands that we do these things. You see? So therefore, we do it because it's God's will. Same thing, killing the enemy of God, where it's halacha, and keeping Shabbos would not be much different. Because we're relating to God. It's all part of God's system. Again, you know what I mean? Keeping, relating to God and going against evil. But it's never personal. If it's personal, that's an attachment to avodah zarah. The personal happiness of somebody failing, that is a component and a quality of avodah zarah. When you enjoy somebody else's failure, when you talk lashon hara and you're happy and you're excited about you hear what this person did or said or the way they dressed, whatever it is, it's looking down on them. That is avodah. That's why lashon hara is considered equal to avodah zarah. There is another difference between idolatry and the terror lifestyle. Okay. In idolatry, you rely on God and everything. In other words, you totally. Reliant, it's like a passive reliance on God's will. And, which you create, really, you created. But, in other words, in idolatry, you're creating who God is, and you're creating what he wants from you. That's what we say in Torah. The religious emotion should never tell you who God is, and should never tell you how to relate to God, but you should, the religious emotion should only drive you to study Torah. And Torah, through Torah, you define who God is, and you define what God wants of you. Okay? But in idolatry, there's a certain passiveness that once you to the God, like for instance, that anything that happens, it's in the hands of God. Everything is in the hands of God. Okay? In Torah, we find that we're responsible, that we have certain responsibilities and certain obligations, okay? Like, for instance, it says that after Moshe gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, after Moshe died, so there was the Chazal say that a few thousand laws were lost. So Yeshua went to God and asked God to give him back the laws. God said, Lo b'shamayim, it's not in heaven anymore. It's not for me to give you. You have to. So Yeshua said, what should I do? So he said, set up a Sanhedrin, a Supreme Court, and then you get together, you discuss it, and vote on it. Okay? So what does it mean when he says it's not in heaven? That Torah is not in heaven anymore. What does that mean? It means that we have responsibility to maintain the system of Torah. Just like we have responsibility to correct our personal lifestyle. If there's something wrong in the way we live our life or the way we make decisions, then we have to correct it. If something happens bad, we stop and think, is there anything that I did wrong that brought this about? Either, in other words, in two ways. One, in the laws of nature, I have to see if I did anything wrong. And two, maybe I did something in relationship to God that I have to straighten out, and therefore this is happening. So the thing is, we have certain responsibility, okay? And when you take on these responsibilities, in other words, when you take on these responsibilities, there's a ratio, a direct ratio, between you, how much you relate to God, how much God relates to you. What you did with your life and how with your thoughts and your ideas, there's a direct ratio, okay? But however, in Avodah Zarah, it's a passivity. It's, this is God's will, and there's nothing I could do about it. You see? This is God's will. It's all in the hands of God. It's a different type of, it's a different personality, you see? We are obligated to take responsibility for ourselves and say, maybe it's happening, maybe God isn't relating to me correctly because I made a mistake, or maybe I made a mistake in the laws of nature, and I have to maintain, I'm obligated to maintain, I'm responsible to maintain the Torah system. Not only keep it, but to maintain it. It's not in heaven anymore. It's not in God's hands anymore. These are the things that God gave over to us to maintain. We have to take responsibility for it. They have no responsibility except God's will. Like, without thought, and they can't. There's no changing. You see, or if they do change, it's maybe in an action. But that's it. But there's no real responsibility. Everything is, well, then it's God's will. Whatever happens is God's will. Well, what about your decision? You decided to do this act. Maybe it's the result of this act? No. I don't take any responsibility for myself. It's all in God's hands. That's another distinction between the lifestyle of Avodah Zarah and the lifestyle of the Torah lifestyle. Even the Ralbach says that when Abraham, when there was a famine in the land and Abraham decided to go down to another land, the other land was evil. It was like we would consider them like Nazis, you see. Now, he had to make a decision between dying of starvation or getting killed by the Nazis. So he probably made some type of a distinction like this, that here I have no chance because it's totally a famine. So maybe I have a 1% chance of living. If I go down there, maybe I could play politics, some type of politics, even because they're human, so maybe I could work it out to have a 3% chance of living. He doesn't throw up his hands and say, okay, God, that's it, I can't do it anymore. You must always, you're responsible. Like, there's a Midrash that says that when Moshe got down to the water and there was the sea in front of him and there was the Egyptians behind him, so he got down to pray. God says, now's not the time to pray, now's the time to act. You see? In other words, if you pray when you're supposed to act, or if you act when you're supposed to pray, you're responsible to make these decisions, to know when to act and to know when to pray. So therefore, that is your responsibility to make these decisions. So therefore, the Torah life gives you a life of responsibility, while the other one, the Avodah Zarah, gives you a life of total passivity, and everything is in God's hands. In Torah, there's a progression of the human personality and a change, like a Torah personality, that's a result of the study of Torah. But however, by Avodah Zarah, it's just totally reliant on God's submissiveness to this God that you've created, but it's still that it's a submissiveness that, and everything is in His hands, and I have no responsibility except to obey the laws that He gave me. But otherwise, everything is in His hands. But there's no change in the personality. In the Shmiras HaLashon, it's found in Perek Yud Zayin, that's chapter 17, Umama Ode, and it's the last paragraph, and he quotes a number of sources for the where the Medrash is. Okay, you could look it up in the Shmir Salah Shom. That you were commanded about the candelabra that was placed in the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? So it says, you are commanded. There's a commentary called the Bala Turim, and he says that the word tetzave, okay, the gematria, everybody knows what gematria is? And the gematria is the numerical value of the word, because in Hebrew, the letters have numerical value. That's how our letters have numerical value. So he says, Begamatri, if you just take the numerical value of the letters, it's equal to Noshem Tziva, that women are commanded. Okay? He says, this is a hint for women to light candles, that it's an obligation on the Sabbath. Okay? So the thing is that the Bala Turim is making a connection between the menorah, that's the candelabra, and the Shabbos candles. In the lighting of Shabbos candles, he's making a connection between the two, and we would like to know what that connection is. And the thing is in general today, in other words, there is a system to gematrias, okay, to working the numerical thing. I think it's lost today. I don't know if it works. I've seen people play with it constantly, and you know what I mean? I don't see anything that they're... I don't see proof that it works. So all I do is accept the results. This was a very wise man. He was the... he must have lived, I would say, around 400, 500 years ago. He's one of our great sages. And so I accept that he understood gematria. So I just accept the results, and then I just analyze the results and try to understand the results. I don't try to understand how he got to it, because I think let's put this way, I definitely don't know the system of gematrias, and I don't know if anybody does. What I'm connecting between the two is I'm just saying that the menorah that was in the Beis HaMikdash is equal to the lighting Shabbos candles.
That is your big point.
Now, if we go back to the last parsha or portion, which was Truma, there they also talk about the menorah, and the same commentary says that in the whole statement where it talks about the menorah, the letter Samach is not there. There's no letter Samach. The Samach and Sin are interchangeable. Okay? In the menorah, where they talk about the menorah in the Parsha of Truma, he says the letter Samach is not there.
So when the next parsha is.
It is. It is in all the other parshas. It is, but it skips that. Then he says the same thing by the beginning in Bereshis. It also lacks the Samach. He says, and remember, the Samach and the Sin are interchangeable. So he says to teach you that where there is light, Neir is the light, candle, and the Satan cannot harm you. Okay? And he continues, and he says, and in the merit, and he quotes a verse, that the candle of a mitzvah, and that Torah is light, you'll close the mouth of Satan from harming you. The results that you have to, that I'm accepting here, it doesn't matter how we got to it, is that the first letter for Satan is not mentioned by the menorah. Okay? Okay? Now, so he says that to teach us where there is light, meaning the candelabra, of the Beis HaMikdash, so Satan can't over, therefore you close the mouth of Satan from affecting you. Okay? That's what he is saying, and that's what we have to discuss. Okay, that idea. In other words, he quotes a verse about the Torah, the keeping of the mitzvot and the study of Torah, and he quotes that verse here. Okay. Now, the word Satan, from what I've seen in Nach, the word Satan is where God wants to punish Israel, and he says he brought a Satan, or he brought a Satan, and he names a king of the enemy to bother him, to bother the king of Israel, because he deserved punishment. In the writings of the sages, Satan is also in other words, he says, they brought a woman into the house to be a Satan to him. In other words, in other words, it awakens the desires and the pleasure, and so therefore it becomes a difficulty, because he's in a situation of difficulty. So therefore, the word Satan seems to imply a situation where the physical world is causing you some type of problem. Either it's a physical problem where you have to work it out, to remind you to repent, like in the Nach, the situation of difficulty that you're going to have to work through, or it's like in the sages, that it's a situation that awakens the evil, your evil inclination to want to do evil. Okay? That's Satan. So he's saying that both the menorah and the Shabbos candles represent the idea of keeping mitzvahs and the study of Torah. That will help you prevent from falling in to the trap of these situations that would awaken your desire, so therefore you could protect yourself through the study of Torah. When these situations come about, you could protect yourself. And now we'd like to understand a little bit more about the Shabbos. Okay, so we have in the Psalms, King David says there's a Psalm of the Sabbath, and it starts off, it's good to praise God, and it has a few verses about praising God. Now, we'll stop there. After these few verses, the chapter would make very good sense, that the essence of the Sabbath is praise of God. But it doesn't stop there. It just says that a fool doesn't understand this. And what doesn't he understand? He doesn't understand that when the wicked are successful and they blossom, okay, that's for their destruction, you see. And then he goes on to the life of the righteous, and then the last verse is again praise of God. Okay, that is correct. In other words, blossoming means as soon as they blossom, you can be sure that they're on their way down, that they're going to destroy themselves. Okay, and the fool doesn't understand this. So we have two questions. Well, first of all, what does he mean here? You understand? And two, what is it doing here? What is it doing by Shabbos? Shabbos has to do, I understand, prayer's a day of praise of God, study of God, and to understand God, I understand, you know, that makes sense. But however, suddenly he throws this in, what is he talking about? In general, in Tillam, many times he's in the middle of a subject, and then he suddenly comes from a totally different angle. Just drops in, you know, you're just shocked. What is it doing here? You have to always investigate that change, that sudden change. Maybe change the subject. You have to investigate the relationship between the two subjects in general. This was Psalm 92. Let's take the wicked one first, okay? See, as a person is more successful, he becomes haughty. He feels that I'm successful. That haughtiness has like a sense of invincibility. And that sense of invincibility says, I can't make a mistake. there's a certain feeling. He wouldn't say it. A person would say it. I mean, if he actually believes that he's God and he's invincible, he'd never be psychotic already. You know what I mean? But there's a certain feeling that that I can't be touched. I could get away with that. But it's a feeling. Now, once you get that feeling of invincibility and that I can't be hurt, then you're going to make terrible mistakes. That is the downfall of the wicked. And the question is that we see, like by Shlomo HaMelech, that he seems to also have gone against God, and he seems to have also been a certain level of haughtiness. Now, you have to understand the difference between the Torah personalities in the Torah, the difference what they are. You see, and that is this. The Torah, in other words, like this, when we're guided in everyday life, basically we're guided by our emotions. We get together to have a discussion so we think clearly. We work step by step, and every question is asked and discussed clearly. But in everyday life, people basically are guided. When you walk out, basically the old emotions come back. And it's a slow process. It could take years before you change your personality. Now, and this, what I'm talking about now is not the level of the Avos, the forefathers that the Torah is talking about. I'm saying that this is a level that we could reach, but it's just enough for us to understand. And that is that suddenly we're guided by studying Torah, studying these ideas again and from all different angles, especially if you study Mishlei, where it keeps going from different angles, the same idea of the consequences of your actions. Suddenly there is a sense of that you start working in life based on your thoughts and not on your emotions. But it doesn't mean you don't have emotions. We don't have saints, we have human beings. So the emotions sneak in and affect our thinking process. Now, I'm only talking about a chacham. Tzaddik is a further development of the mind. What King David calls a chassid is a further development of the mind. And then there's the Navi, I mean, which is a much further development of the mind. So it's people that are guided to very, very high levels by the mind. I'm only giving an example of the first stage, the chacham, that he changes his view of life. But even those greats had certain emotions that affected their thinking process. Now, the wicked, they could be thinkers, but the thinking is based on their emotions. Like, for instance, they have a desire for power. Now they think through strategies of war or politics, how to be successful in their power, in their search for power or wealth, whatever it may be. So they use that type of knowledge, but it's the knowledge is the servant of the world of ideas. So therefore you have to be very careful. A lot of people learn Torah and they read about our forefathers and they look at them like our emotions and they interpret the stories like it's our feelings. It's not true. They're in a different ballpark. They're in a totally different ballpark on a very high level of development. Okay? So therefore, any comparison between what we've said about the wicked and what the Torah says that Shlomo made an error is two very different ballparks. So we took care of the wicked person, and namely, his success makes a change in the mind, and he feels he can't fail. Once he feels he can't fail, so then he'll make terrible mistakes. He won't be careful, and he'll make terrible mistakes. Who is the fool that doesn't understand this? The fool is, let's say, a person that's starting out in Judaism. Could be a young person, a child, or could be a person that's just starting out as an adult. Now, they have a certain religious emotion, and they accept the truth of Torah. Okay? But however, let's say, for instance, they would see the wicked people, how successful they are with the, you know, the stretch limousines, and they have a house here and they have a house there. They have all their desires satisfied, and they look at them with jealousy and they say, "Boy, you know, they're so lucky they could have these things. Or a teenager might see his friends, you know, going to a dance Friday night, and then by day they go to football, they ride their bicycle, or they play their video games, whatever it is, and he feels jealous of them that he's stuck on Shabbos, that he's stuck and he can't do these things. He does the correct thing, but he doesn't but he looks at everybody else superficially, and he looks outside, it looks like they're in good shape, like they're having a good time. You see? The wise person is a person that recognizes in reality he could go beneath the surface, and since he goes beneath the surface, he sees that the success, it's not only the ultimate wicked, but even people in the life of pleasure, all the different ways against Torah, he sees that leads to destruction. It leads to failure. In the long run, they will fail if you're not guided by the life of Torah. That's what the Chacham sees. See, the Chacham sees this idea of that if you don't live the life of Torah, you're going to fail. You don't live the life of wisdom or Chachma, you're going to fail. He sees that. He's not jealous of the success of the wicked. It doesn't bother him because he knows if they're successful, that's the beginning of their end. He understands it, you see? But the fool, what he's calling the fool here, is a good person. We're not talking about a fool like we call a person a stupid person. It's a beginner that doesn't recognize yet the value of the life of Torah, and to really see that the life of Torah is the best possible life. Okay? Now what happens is the change, if you're a fool and you change to be a chacham, what happens is like this. See, most people are born with a certain sense of reality. Okay? And now, for instance, when a child is trained, a two-year-old is trained not to go in the street, so he's afraid of his parents. And because of his parents are going to be angry with him, so he doesn't do it. Right? But however, we hope by the time he's 15, he realizes that the car could do more damage than his parents would ever do. So the thing is that there's a certain sense of reality as you develop, and when he looks two ways when he crosses the street at 15, he recognizes, not because of his parents he does this, but he does it because he recognizes the harm of the car. Now the same thing in the development of Torah. When we start out by accepting an authority. We accept God, that God knows all, and we listen to him. But however, it's not real to us that this is the best possible life. Through the study of Torah, we extend the sense of reality that the human being has, we extend it to the world of ideas. Okay? So that the world of ideas also become real to me, and it becomes so real that when I see the successful person, I'm not jealous of him, because I know if he's a wicked person, if he's a righteous person, his success will remain. If it's a wicked person, he's going to fail. You see, so I know that. So therefore, there's nothing to be jealous of the wicked, and I'm happy for the righteous. You see? So the thing is a person that he calls a fool is a person that is religious, but he doesn't see that there's two ways of looking at God commanding us. In other words, I have to obey God because he commanded us, right? Or God commanded us because it is good. See, the fool just obeys God, and he doesn't look at it that, well, maybe it's a real good. He just accepts God's will, you see. That's the fool, whatever his motive is. The wise person recognizes that when God commands us, it's for our good, so therefore I have the right to see how it is good. When I see how it is good, then I can't be affected by any jealousy or anything, because I see it as a good. I see it's a better type of life. In other words, there are two ways of looking at God. One, I look at God as an authority, so I obey him whatever he says. The other, I look at God as he's the source of reality, so then I have to see how it is a reality, how the reality works, you see? So then once I see how the reality works, then I see that this is a better life than any life that exists. This is the best possible life that a person could have on this planet. Okay? Now, what does this have to do with the with this chapter of Psalms, of the Sabbath? The answer is that God wants us, according to King David, that the highest level of praise of God is where your reality, your sense of reality attaches to ideas. And that has to be because since God is an abstract entity, and how God relates to us is an abstract entity, so therefore the only way it could be real to you that God, that how God relates to us or any knowledge of God to be able to praise God must be based on that sense of reality. That where the sense of reality has extended to the world of ideas. In other words, like this, in the world around us, if a person has a lot of knowledge, he is considered wise. We measure him by the quantity of knowledge that he has. While our level of development is not how much knowledge you have, but how real it is, how real that knowledge is, and that knowledge becomes real by extending the sense of reality from the five senses to the world of ideas. Only then praise of God has meaning, because then you really see the true God, and then you really see that you should praise him. So therefore, the Sabbath, the Shabbos in general, is for the purpose to recognize God on the highest level of recognition, namely where in reality you see God, what God is, so that you could praise him in reality. Okay? Now, the same thing when we come back to the Shabbos light and the menorah, that represents this idea where Torah and mitzvot are real to us. It is that type of knowledge, only that type of knowledge that you could have to prevent from a situation of destroying you. In other words, if you have this type of knowledge and you're guided totally by this reality, you'll be able, any type of situation which could hurt you, whether it's people out to hurt you or whether there's a situation where your evil inclination is awakened, so then you will have the knowledge to be able to protect yourself, and that is the idea of the Shabbos candles and the menorah, that if you have this type of knowledge, it'll help you defeat the situation that is overpowering you. And the lighting of the candles, and whether it's the menorah or the Shabbos candles, represents, supposed to remind you of the idea that only a sense of reality that attaches to the world of ideas, only that sense of reality can protect you against the physical world. And Shabbos in general, is supposed to be that praise of God can only come when your sense of reality attaches to the world of ideas. So Shabbos represents the praise of God, that you need a sense of reality for the praise of God, and the Shabbos candles represent that same type of knowledge to be able to protect you against different situations that can harm you. Insofar as a Noahite that does not keep the Sabbath, you see, but he could have this idea and he could set aside time to develop his sense of his or her sense of reality. In other words, they don't have the commandment to light the Sabbath candles or to keep the Sabbath, but they can learn from this the view of what the Sabbath, how it points to certain ideas. The ideas, they could live the ideas. Let's say, for instance, like sometimes Nochai wants to do something on Sabbath, you understand, to feel a connection to the Torah. So they don't keep the commandments, but however, they could set aside that day for a day of study so that they should have that they should help reach this level of wisdom, where wisdom is where the ideas are real to you. You see? So therefore, they could say they don't have to keep the commands of the Sabbath, but however, they would keep they would develop the idea and maybe spend a little more time on the Sabbath to develop it if they so wish, even though they don't have to. In other words, for Judaism, God had set aside the time; He obligated us for a day of study. For other peoples, they should take the idea and set aside time for the life of study. They are not obligated on the Sabbath in particular, but they're obligated to set aside time. But they can set aside time in particular on the Sabbath if they so wish. In other words, in relationship to God, there's two types of mindsets. There's one mindset that God is an authority. So then I just look at him as an authority like any other authority. I mean, he's the highest authority, I hold that, but my emotions relate to him as an authority, and therefore all the emotions, how it relates to authority, has its conflicts and problems. But then you could look at God as the source of all reality, you see, so then anything he says, I must understand how it fits into reality. So therefore my mind doesn't accept him he is an authority, but I relate to him as the source of all reality. It's a different mindset.
Right.
Yeah. Right. We want to say the question is that that the American education system is contrary to the Jewish education, because we hold that the first thing is the training of the mind, and they hold that the more knowledge you have, you should be open to all knowledge, and all knowledge should be available to everybody. So we want an answer like this: that that once your mind is trained, then you should be open to more knowledge. Then it's good to be open to more knowledge, even false knowledge, to see that false knowledge is really incorrect. If you have the ability to investigate it, then you should investigate it and see that it's false. But for beginners, to have a lot of knowledge would only confuse them, because they do not know how to handle it, and therefore the first thing the person should be taught is how to train their mind and to become wise. Then later on, where they'll know how far they should go and into other areas, and where how far it's beneficial and where it becomes harmful, so that becomes a further development. I'd like to talk about traits. That people have different traits, like laziness, vengeance, anger, all these different traits. Now, the thing is, most of the time, like, let's take laziness. Most of the time, you think of laziness as a...
We'll do that tomorrow.
Okay, so laziness is usually a trait that... It's a bad trait, because there's certain consequences that you get from the trait. Right? So from basically all the bad traits, you get certain consequences. But however, there is not only consequences that you get from the traits, but there is a certain view of life that you also have when you have these traits. Like, for instance, Lashon Hara. Speaking gossip, right? Now, Lashon Hara, speaking gossip, is a negative view of people, you see. and you always find the fault with the person. But you'll notice whenever you do something, you always have a reason why it's not wrong, why it's right. Right? Okay. Now, the thing is that if we think correctly, then with the facts that are given, that either you've heard, somebody told you Lashon Hara, right? Or somebody did something where you see something that seems to be bad. You can find a reason that is not bad why the person did that. Okay? In other words, there's a statement in Pirkei Avos that says, Don Lakovskis, you should judge for... you should judge a person by looking for merit. For bad, that the person did it in a good way. That's the opposite of Lashon Hara. But we naturally see traits. Sometimes it's very far from the fact, but we naturally see the negative in people, and we cannot see anything positive about other people. What we have to do is see, just like we find benefits for ourselves, we should be able to find merit for other people too. And just like we find, on the contrary, when you find fault with others, that's what you should look in your own self as the fault, so that you could better yourself. But if you excuse yourself, so then you're not going to benefit yourself. So it's really a harmful thing both ways. Okay? But the main thing is the view of life that you look at people negatively. The question is, how does it get started? I didn't get started by jealousy. When you're angry with somebody, like vengeance, you understand? Ego, somebody touches onto your ego. So you want to put them down. And it's definitely a certain cowardice, too. Because the thing is, you can't tell them to their face. You wouldn't tell them to their face. So you talk negatively behind their back, and these are the traits that make you look at other people in a negative manner. Right. The question is the statement in Pirkei Avos, where it says you should judge somebody for merit, you should look for the merit of a person instead of the negative quality, the question is, shouldn't we judge a person objectively, you say? And the truth is that if you have 100% proof and knowledge of a certain act, definitely you have to live by the reality. But in most cases, you find that there is no research, no analysis done. You just come to conclusions. Looking for a person's merits is a training to be able to see two sides, the two possibilities, so that you could make a rational decision and analyze which possibility is correct, the negative one or the meritorious one, you see? So the thing is that because naturally we look at things in a negative manner, we have to push the other side. But it doesn't mean that if I have 100% proof of a certain act, that means that I should change that act and make it for meritorious. The question is that it is, when you talk Lashon Hara, it is not in all areas of life that you talk gossip. Each person talks gossip in certain areas, and they look for certain negative qualities. That happens to be true. I mean, what you're saying is true, but the fact is that they're looking for negative qualities. The type of negative qualities that they're looking for is different in different people. But the fact is that they're looking for negative qualities. It's true, certain people, but most people have similar things. In other words, it has to do with either vengeance or jealousy. You know, different aspects. The ego. The way they put them down, It could be each person, according to their personality, looks at it slightly differently, and they different aspect of it. But the fact is that what they all have in common is that it is they're just looking for the negative quality and not a meritorious quality, which most of the times, if you listen to gossip, the facts that are given could really have both possibilities. Another example is laziness, okay? Laziness is a person wants, in other words, it's where he wants results and he cannot stand the means. He doesn't want the means, you see? So he looks at the means in a negative manner. Like he'll do the least possible. See, the act is you do the least possible, but the view of life is not really being involved in reality and dealing with the realistic part of it. In other words, the work. In other words, like, for instance, in life, there are two things. We always say, some of the people are driven by two things, by pleasure and avoidance of pain. Now, all practicality that you do in life is avoidance of pain. You got to work so you could eat. You know what I mean? You got to work so you could have a house over your head. You understand? You have clothing. You got to go to work. It's a practical thing. Now, if you're in reality, so then you recognize that the practicality, you even enjoy the practicality because you recognize that the practicality is part of life. It's a reality, so you relate to the reality, and you know that if you do it in the best possible way, it'll come out in the best possible way. It's even like a strategy of working it out, of thinking it through, the enjoyment of working it through, working it out. Years ago, people took a certain pride in their work. And today, it's just get it off, just make sure you get the money as fast, and you don't care how bad it is. So it's a certain negative view of reality. It's a lack of reality. It's a certain loss of reality that you just don't recognize that this is part of life. You refuse to accept a certain aspect of life as reality, and you feel you could get everything just by getting the results, and you just go after the results. So, again, it's a certain negative view of here it's a view of, in other words, it's the view, the trait is, well, it's not only the consequences by not doing it correctly or not doing it, but the fact is that you have an incorrect view of reality. You feel that means are not important. The means are important. That's most of life, is the practicality. The question is that there's sometimes a person has a feeling of like despair, which they just give up hope and they say, look, it can't be done. Like there's just too much and it can't be done. To say the truth is that never should happen. I mean, a person that recognizes practicality should recognize that look, you have to do within a human what a human should do. Now, if it should be done, then you should do it. It takes a little longer. It's a little complicated. It can be worked out. You have to think about it. Work it out. What's the best way? Sometimes you have to pull out of the situation to think, maybe I'm doing it wrong. Maybe I got to do it a different way. You see? So the thing is, despair also is, it's a different emotion. It's not laziness. But the fact is that you're giving up on life, and that's also an incorrect view of life, where life is like has destroyed, like it's like a battle, like you battle with somebody and you lose and you just give up. I can't fight anymore. I don't have any fight, you see. That is also an incorrect view of life, because you never know, you know what I mean? It can be, you know, understand? And if you can't do it, then you have to make a decision that this can't be done. Now, what should I do? How should I deal with the situation? But it should never be in despair. That's a different, it's not laziness. Despair is not laziness. But it is similar that you don't use the means anymore because you just feel you can't get the end. In laziness, I'm only interested in the end. In despair, I just give up. Like, even though it might why should you give up? Maybe you can work it out another way. Unless you have a proof that there's no way of working it out, then it also shouldn't be despair, and it should be a decision what to do in a situation where you can't do it. Hey, James wants to give two examples of laziness, okay? In other words, he says one type of laziness is you have two jobs that you have to do, and you don't go according to priority, but you go according to what is easier for you or more enjoyable for you. So it's a laziness that's made an incorrect decision. Then there's a laziness where I have to do something, like I have a job, or I'm at school, and I have to do certain work, you see? Now, but the only thing is, I only do enough to be accepted. In other words, to get a grade, a passing grade, or to be accepted, I shouldn't be fired. But it's not enough to really do the best for that given situation. So that is, in other words, laziness is not always that you just sit down and do nothing. Laziness is also where, in other words, practicality demands that you have a job. Practicality demands that you go to school. But because you are lazy, so you don't put yourself into the job completely, but what you do is you do enough to keep the job, because that's practical, but you don't get into the practicality, so you don't do the best, and you don't get the most out of what you are doing. And in a way, it's, insofar as business is concerned, it's like a cheating, because you're hired to do the job, do the best that you can. And insofar as school is concerned, you're harming yourself, because you need an education to get ahead in life, and you don't have the education, you're going to come in with less than what you need. So the thing is that these are examples, different examples of laziness that James has given. In other words, these are all cases of laziness, but laziness shows up in different aspects. And since it shows up in different aspects, so it's, but they're all the same, it's all the same thing, that you don't recognize the value of practicality. And practicality is not important to you, it's only results, and your laziness shows up in different ways. It shows up in different ways. What we're talking about, it's not the consequences that we're talking about. We're all aware of the consequences, but it's a certain view of life where only results are important, but practicality is not. In other words, sometimes a lazy person doesn't think about the result at all at the present, because he just denies the fact that he needs the result, so that the when it comes to it, he really doesn't have it. There are also people that are lazy about their pleasures. There's too much preparation, then they won't take that pleasure, even though they might enjoy it more. So again, it's the view that you do anything not to do the means. The means is like a terrible thing to him. So he refuses to do the means, and he is not involved in any type of practice. He can't enjoy any type of practicality, which is a certain loss, because most of life is practical. You can't just enjoy, there's a lot of enjoyments in life, but one of them could be practicality, where you enjoy working it out and see how it works, and the different parts to it. Putting things together is a certain enjoyment too, but he can't look at it that way. There are certain people that will work hard to do that which is necessary, but they hate it. They know that it has to be done, and they do it in a good way, but yet emotionally they still hate the means. They still dislike the means, okay? That type of person has a sense of reality, and therefore a strong sense of reality. In other words, the lazy people that we were talking about up until now in other words, their sense of reality is lacking. Certain sense of reality that is lacking. But here the sense of reality is strong, but not enough to affect them emotionally. In other words, there is a point where reality affects the emotions and the emotions accepts the reality. You see, this case is an in-between case where the person, the sense of reality is enough to do the job, but however, the outlook of the emotions, the person is still in conflict with the means. They're in conflict with the means because there's a part of them that still doesn't accept that reality. So therefore, there is still the battle that they have to work through, and if they could be successful, then emotionally they could accept that. It's an interesting thing. Like the example was making your taxes, but working out your taxes. Now, the thing is, it's a complicated thing, but after a while, you start thinking about it, and the different ways of thinking about it, could the way you work it out, what you can take off, what you can't take off, what the government allows, what the government doesn't allow, what situations and all these things can be enjoyable. But, of course, with taxes, there's a certain pressure. So, you know, understand, so therefore you don't like it because of the pressure. So the thing is, once the emotions, you got to get the emotions in line with the idea. First, most people, they have to get it into their mind, the reality that they're not in line with reality. They're not living in reality. And things will break down because they don't do things well, and they don't have a good foundation. Whenever they're doing things, it's going to break down. That's by most lazy people. But to them, they need to extend their sense of reality in general. But however, the person that we're talking about is in reality, is living in reality. And that's a good thing. But however, they're living in reality, but they have a conflict. The Rambam talks about two levels of a tzaddik. One, there's a tzaddik in conflict, and that means irrationally he knows what's right, and he does it and lives the life of righteousness, but he's in conflict about it. He still has the old desires. So that person has set the lower level of a tzaddik. Higher level of a tzaddik, where his emotions are in line with the truth. I say the same thing with this lazy person that you described.